thinking big thoughts, so you don't have to.
Thinking.
Here's John Williams.
Green took a walk to the L tracks today and noticed the grass is actually not just green and emerging, but getting taller. And little buds on my trees and the bark of some of the bushes. They don't have leaves on them yet, but that's turning green. It's a beautiful thing. We're at WGNRadio.com. Everyone's doing it.
A friend of mine said the president is cuckoo bananas, and I said that is so unfair to bananas. Now we don't speak anymore.
If you're not yourself these days.
That is, my friend and I don't speak.
Because of stress from the daily news cycle.
I still talk to bananas. Wait, I don't talk to bananas.
You may have politosis.
They don't pick up, so now I just text them.
It's time to try Eurelium Life 9000.
Eurelium. Is that the Sterigenics people in Willowbrook?
No. Eurelium Life 9000 is the all-natural wonder drug made by an ethnically blended group of scientists wearing white lab coats in New Jersey.
Will it make this news cycle anxiety go away?
Oh, it will.
How will I take this wonderful new product? And please tell me it comes as one of those things where I shoot warm water in one nostril and it comes out the other.
Try Eurelium Life 9000 as a pill, capsule, gel cap, liquid, IV, eye drop, ear burst, time release arm patch, suppository. There's the experimental home epidural kit. Or you could use one of those things where you shoot warm water in one nostril and it comes out the other.
Hooray!
Side effects include weight loss, weight gain, and wait, don't tell me. Some patients have also experienced bleeding, wheezing, heaving, stinking, and uncontrollable winking.
Uncontrollable winking? I'd like to try that.
Then try Eurelium Life 9000. Say goodbye to political anxiety and maybe hello to a fun new side effect.
I'll tell my banana. His name is Henry.
Fun new side effects, just another reason to take Eurelium Life 9000 for your politosis, that is, political anxiety. Hopefully none of that for you today. We're here until 3 o'clock at WGNRadio.com, normally heard at WGN Radio, but today we are giving way for the Chicago White Sox as they take on somebody here in Chicago. 50 degrees, sunshine, beautiful day yesterday, too. I can't tell you just how nice it was walking to my train today, not dressed like Jon Snow.
I just got a little break, walked to Millennium Park.
Yeah.
Around the band shell a little
Isn't
bit.
Isn't that nice?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm not going to do it tomorrow or the next day.
I know.
I'll say the world.
For God's sakes. I don't know if this winter seems to have lagged longer. Do we say this every year?
Well, here's the thing. I'll take it because what we haven't had this year are the good days like yesterday.
Yeah.
Like the teaser days. We usually get a couple in March or something. And we really haven't had many. So
you're singing my Brenda's song. She goes, you know, I don't know if this is a lot worse or than normal, but we haven't had those 2, 3, 60 and sunnies where everybody's out riding their bicycles.
Exactly. That's what we've been missing.
Yeah. So it's just taking its damn sweet time. I've got this app on my phone. It shows 10 days out the forecast. And all that does is make me depressed for a week and a half at a time. You know, like if it only was 3 days, I go, well, maybe in the fourth day it'll get better. I'm pretty miserable today for what's going to happen for the next 10. Well, that's not good. So then I have on my phone app all of the places that we've traveled to or are going to travel. I've got London on there. I'm always looking at the weather in London. London, which is sort of on a line of longitude or latitude, like it's as high as Anchorage. It's way up there. They're having a nicer spring than we are.
Well, that's good.
I don't know. How does that help me? I'm here.
Don't look at Scotland, though, because, you know.
It's going to be bad?
Well, I mean, it's, you know, it rains sometimes in Scotland. No, April is the best month to travel, right? You said that.
I did look that up, and somebody who was selling me tickets said that, so.
I just said, yeah, that's right.
That's a Steve Bertrand Travel. That's the website, Steve Bertrand Travel. Probably too late for you to get on the plane with Brenda and me and about 35 WGN listeners going to London and then Scotland.
But not too late to go to Ireland with Sharon and me in September.
I say, there's always another trip down the road. Did you hear my little mini rant about Dr. Dow, the guy that got dragged off the United flight?
Yeah, I didn't see that he was interviewed today. Or
he was on Good Morning America. If you don't know the story, he is this, I don't know how old he is. It probably says in the story here, doesn't it, Elif? Did you catch this guy's age? Do you know how old he is, Elif?
He's 69.
He was plucked from the waters off of Vietnam by the U.S. Navy during the war. They didn't shoot him or kill him. I don't know that he was Viet Cong, but he was trying to flee that country, and he's forever been indebted to the United States for what happened to him in the war. He's come to the United States. He's become a doctor. I'm not exactly sure what his career trajectory is like. I'm not 100% sure I want this guy tending to me medically, but he was on this plane, and he said, no, they're going to open up this VA clinic that he's been instrumental in, and he needs to be there. So he's on the flight. United says that we have crew that needs to get on this flight, and four of you, two, I believe, couples have to get bumped. And he lost for some reason in the lottery, so he has to get off. And they come up and ask him, and he says, no, we won't get off. And then what you see is the video of him being dragged, screaming and screeching. I think that's the first cut we have, right, Elif?
They run a car for the pilots and have them drive.
People could not believe what they were seeing. This screaming elderly man with his glasses knocked off his face, some blood. He's literally being dragged off of the plane. He's rump and backside down, so they're just hauling him off by his arms. They bang his head against some of the support for the seats. He has a concussion. He loses a couple of teeth as they're hauling him off. Here's another cut of that. No, so then you remember. Then, and I don't know exactly what happened, but he gets dragged off the plane and then comes back onto the plane moments later. I don't know how he escaped the clutches of TSA, but somehow or another, he's now back on the plane heading back towards his seat.
Just heal me. Heal me. Relax, heal me. Relax. I have to go home. I have to go home.
He's running back onto the plane saying, just kill me, just kill me. I have to go home, I have to go home. Okay.
Is he saying, just kill me or excuse me?
Try it again, Elif. Cut two.
Just kill me. Kill me. Relax, kill me. Relax.
I have to go home. I don't know. What do you think?
I'm going with excuse me.
Oh, no, that's just kill me.
Really?
Okay. Lapka, you'll get to decide. Let's try one more time. 3, 2, 1, woof.
Just kill me. Kill me. Relax, kill me. Relax. I have to go home. I have to go home.
Yeah, there's a little too much of an L sound there for me to go with excuse me. I can kind of hear the last one sound like excuse me, but I think, John, you're right. Which
well,
is very excessive. That's a little dramatic.
Either way.
For John to be right?
Either way, I don't care if he was saying eeny, meeny, miny, mo. Running down, he's running back onto the plane. Presumably he's lost his tooth now. And he's concussed. And he's bleeding. He's literally bleeding from the face. And he's running back down the aisle. I have to go home. I have to go home. What are you, Dorothy? You get. Maybe by now he's so distraught that he's not thinking clearly, that maybe he knows this is irrational behavior. Right now, I'm thinking, after the run down the aisle, excuse me, just kill me thing, now you're definitely not getting on the plane, right? I mean, maybe he should have been allowed to stay on, and maybe the first time we'd give him a pass, but when he's exhibiting this kind of behavior, when he's this traumatized, maybe you would say, through no fault of his own, fine. But I don't think anybody wants to fly with this guy now. So he goes on the Good Morning America show for the first time ever. This was not a live studio interview the way I saw it. This was a package where one of their reporters interviewed him, and then they played part of the interview and talked a little bit about it. Here is his reaction to what happened.
Have you watched the video?
Later on.
What's that like to watch?
I just cry.
You can hear you screaming in pain.
I don't know. I just cry.
I don't know. I just cry. Cut two is on the escalation of events, how quickly things got out of control on the plane.
Were you expecting it to get physical at any point?
No, no, not at all.
I don't know if we're going to have the audio here, but at one point I saw today, you know, some original videos that somebody was shooting, and it's where the airline attendant says, sir, you have to get off the plane. And he's on his phone. And then he snaps his phone off and he goes, no, I'm not getting off. I am not getting off the plane. He's belligerent. Now, after the fact, he says, if they had asked more politely, if they had shown me a little more consideration, my attitude would have been different. Whatever. But it's clear that they said, sir, we need you to get off the plane. And he was just as adamant, no, I'm not getting off the plane. That audio and video exists. So here's cut three now. about what he had to do after the fact.
How did you handle all of that attention?
You get the pull, I had to hide him.
Could you go to work? Could you leave the house?
No. I stayed for months in the house.
Stayed for months in his house. And finally, cut four from the Good Morning America interview. He at least sees that he was an agent of change.
The most important thing is the accident turned out a positive way. Airline business willing to change policy.
You've forgiven?
Yes.
So the airline has now changed the policy and he's forgiven them. In fact, he said he had no animosity towards the men who dragged him off, even though two of them got fired for trying to do their job with an out-of-control belligerent passenger. I mean, I have not healed from the trauma of watching this story unfold. Imagine if I were on that plane. But he said he has no animosity towards those people because they had a job to do, which is kind of weird. So then what is this all about? If you have no animosity towards those people, you understand they had a job to do, then why didn't you help them do the job? Why did you not get off the plane? They do not say how much he settled for, but he got himself an attorney with a fancy tie, and they settled with United for an undisclosed amount, which I'm thinking is $11 zillion, and I just think that's insane. I don't know, am I alone on this? My number is 312-981-7200. You can call or text.
John, we're in a world where everyone wants to sue everyone for anything.
I think
that's
this
how
is,
I feel.
I know that, and I think this is one of those examples.
And that's why he's forgiven them.
Yeah. And since I got a revendizillion dollars, I'm okay with it now. I just think that's, you know, could everybody have handled this better? Yeah, but I am such a, I don't know, I guess we all just approach flying in airplanes differently. I don't think you should put your seat back because you need to accommodate the person behind you. I don't like people who have such large suitcases that they can barely get it in the overhead, because we should all try and find a way to accommodate one another. And if that means you got to check your bag, you got to check your bag. If they come up to you and say, sir, we need you to get off the plane, I think, okay, we need to get off the plane. If they said, sir, we need you to actually sit on the wing and serve sandwiches to some crows out there, I would go, well, okay, crows got to eat. I mean, that's just my attitude about air flight. I don't know that I'm that accommodating in other parts of my life, but I think on an airplane, I know that I am. So if they say you've got to get off the plane, I just do not understand the no, I'm not getting off the plane attitude. You know, I think it was embarrassing for the airline in that the people that were going to take his seats were other United Airline staff members, and I'm assuming that they said, and these were people that needed to get somewhere. I'm assuming that they needed to get to another hub or destination from which they would then fly. I mean, they're moving planes and personnel around, and you may not like that, but that's how airlines work. If it were other passengers and they simply were that overbooked, would that change the story? I don't care who it was. If somebody said, actually, sir, two goats and a chicken are going to sit in those seats, you would have to go, well, you know, goats got to fly too. Okay, I guess I have to get off now. You have to do what they say you have to do.
Well, and I mean, why you'd put yourself in peril over it is the one thing.
Yeah.
Like, I'm not going to leave. And then when they start to take you, it's like, okay, I guess I'm going.
I know. Right. So were these wounds just a little self-inflicted? And the Good Morning America interview, they're the kings and queens of this. Their hands are folded in their lap. Oh, sir. Well, then how do you feel about your daughter who stood up for you so courageously? You know, he says, I just cried. Most of his answers were, I just cry. And I'm thinking, okay. Would somebody mind asking him a hard question, please? I'm the opposite, right? My first question would be, you're an idiot, right? And you should have been thrown out at 30,000 feet, right? That would have been my opening question.
You know what? The story that strikes me the most, it's the people who have to exclaim when he's being dragged out. Like, they have to narrate it. The very first cut you played, oh, my God, oh, look at him, oh, my God. It's like, why do you have to talk out loud? I don't understand that.
Oh, I really, Steve? Because
yeah.
When I hear that, let's go to cuts one and two again.
I'd be like, hey, what are you guys doing? Stop it or something like that. But I wouldn't just be jabbering.
I thought the response from the passengers was directed at the marshals that were coming onto the plane.
Listen to them. They're just exclaiming.
Okay, so here's cut one.
They're
run a car for the pilots in heaven's right?
Come on!
No!
I count five, oh my God. And that's your problem, huh?
Sort of, yeah.
So what? So you're on the plane, Steve. What do you say?
I would be like, what are you doing? Or
hey,
stop it. Or
right, hey,
you know,
why don't you stop dragging him and let him gather himself? I'll bet he'll walk off.
I wouldn't be like, oh my God. I'm videotaping. This is going to show up.
Okay, here's cut two. Oh, text is just poured in to my phone, and it says, I think he was saying, excuse me. Cut two.
Just kill me.
The last part's even the weirdest in a way. Whatever he was saying at the beginning, we would all agree that he's running down the aisle going, I have to go home, I have to go home. Did he think, like, and again, I know he's been traumatized. He really has. This guy is not in a right mind. But did he think running bloodied back down onto the plane and diving into his seat going, I have to go home, they would have said, oh, okay. I mean, did he think that was going to work? Okay. So, 312-981-7200. Your turn to call or text. Thanks for finding us on the stream. We're talking about Dr. Dow, who got dragged off that United Airlines flight. It was heading from O'Hare in 2017. He settled with the airline. He was on Good Morning America talking about it for the first time, giving his side of the story. And I'm asking you what your reaction is to that, and for that matter, to my reaction. You know what I like to say?
I love a parade.
I love it when everybody just
standing up feet. I love every beat. I hear of a drum.
Calls in and says, John, couldn't agree with you more. This is 773. John, you're alone on this. The man had a valid ticket, and they wanted to remove him from the plane. 815. The man has a very strong accent, but he was saying, excuse me, not just kill me. 847 says, John, you're wrong. The airline clearly did not offer enough incentive for a person to voluntarily leave the plane. Overbooking was their fault. They need to resolve the issue without the need of beating a customer. Here's one. 847. John, I'm with you 100%. 224 says, I agree with John.
Are you self-texting again?
847 says, I don't think an airline should be able to take a seat away from a passenger who booked a flight. But since it is their written right, this guy was an idiot for the drama. And 501, John, you always side with authority. I'll have to go back and review the tapes. I don't know. I haven't even thought about that.
Well, I agree with the person who said that the person that bought the ticket has every right to stay on the plane, because unless you're being offered some sort of compensation, and good compensation, then you shouldn't have to relinquish your seat.
That's true, Ella, but when they start shooting you, you get out of the line of fire.
when they walk on with a Tommy gun.
Right.
What was the airline? Which country was it that sued people for doing that trick where you, I forgot what it was called.
It's where you want to go from here to Los Angeles.
You do a layover, but you actually end up in your layover spot.
Right. And then get off.
Flight.
And that's cheaper.
Yeah. So if they can sue for that, then why are they giving people crap for their overbooked seats?
You make an interesting point, and I have not considered that. That normally they just buy people off the plane. They go, okay, now it's $200, now it's $400. And if it gets to $38,000, you know, down payment on a nice size home, somebody will get off the plane. I don't know where they were in that scheme, Elif, and shame on me for not knowing that, because that would have alleviated all of this. Somebody else would have gotten off the plane, right? Somebody else would have.
Well, they should have also asked other people.
You've been on a plane before, right? Where they do that, where they go, hi, everybody, we're overbooked.
Yeah.
And they sometimes do this in the gate. I have it in my mind that I was sitting on a tarmac one time. We were in our seats, and there's somebody going, you know, we're overbooked. We're offering $800. It just keeps going up until finally somebody stands up and kind of sheepishly goes, I'll take $800. And they walk off the plane. And really, since this is a problem of the airline's creation, right? They need to just keep upping the ante to fix it, not drag somebody off the plane. Completely agree with you on that.
Well,
that didn't happen. But that didn't happen.
Right. So you're confused. We're confusing scenarios here because the airlines was, the way he was handled was wrong. I think we all agree with that. Right? I mean, we all agree he should not have been dragged by his hair off the plane. So given, given mistakes were made. But the point is his behavior, again, if they start to shoot at you, you dodge the bullet. You get up and walk off.
He fueled the fire a bit. I think that's what you're trying to say, Steve.
Yeah.
I agree.
Well, this texter says about Steve, I want to hear Steve Bertrand say, oh, my God, like a woman from New Jersey again. Steve, would you go ahead and say, oh, my
God.
Here's another text. You make no sense, John. You say he's traumatized, then you ridicule him because he's not acting rationally. I think it's a self-inflicted wound. It's 1:31, so Dr. Dow is okay. I mean, he stuff lingers. He's not able to run the way he used to. He can run 3 miles, not 26. I don't know how much money he got. I really would be curious. I think that would really give us a sense of how much responsibility each side accepted. And if he accepted $800, you know, like you might have gotten if you'd just taken time, that's one thing. If he got $800,000, then I think that's the airline saying, boy, did we screw up. The airline essentially did in that they said their policy will change, and they apologize to him. But I'd like to, I'm always curious about that number. John Williams at WGNRadio.com, normally heard weekdays 1 to 3 at WGN Radio as well. White Sox baseball, you just heard, is on the radio side. We appreciate you finding us here at WGNRadio.com, or maybe you're listening to us on your smart speaker. I'm sorry if my take on the Dr. Dow's story being dragged off the United Airlines flight seemed unduly mean or judgmental. But, yeah, I'm judging him. We all are, or what happened there. The airline, as Steve said, was complicit. I 100% agree with that. But you heard my explanation for my attitude, and that is if somebody taps you on the shoulder and says you got to get off the plane, you have to get off the plane. I'm utterly compliant in that. Maybe I'm a little bit different. So, yeah, when somebody doesn't cooperate and when they just completely go bananas, I think get a grip. That's my take on it. But 269 said, wow, just wow. He's pretty clearly the victim. You're suggesting that it would have been okay to throw him out of the air at 30,000 feet? I was not speaking literally when I said that. Yes, maybe he should not have decided his life is just as important as the airline wanted and done what they asked. As for running back on, he just had the absolute bleep kicked out of him. It's impacted his quality of life since. And you're also blaming him for how he responded to being beaten up. He defaulted back to his goal of the day, going home, where he feels safe. Your incorrect reading of this and lack of compassion here is incredibly disturbing. I'm tempted to say you're just trolling listeners to get some big reactions and fill the airtime. Well, some of that last sentence is true.
No, those guys left about 5 years ago.
we've been told how to do that. Yeah, I fill the airtime. It's what I do for a living. But I have not said anything I don't honestly and truly personally feel. And I invite your reaction. That's why I'm reading this text. And then they're back and forth. John, I have zero sympathy for him. John, it was random, so it was fair. He should have gotten off. He didn't own that seat. Etc., etc. So, let's move on. By the way, I'll ask Thomas Jefferson how he feels about that. First, I'll explain air flight. But Thomas Jefferson's going to join us at the Tivoli Theater. In the past, last several years, we've done it at the College of DuPage. We were in Elgin for the last appearance by one of our favorite presidents. But we've been at the College of DuPage a lot. But this time, we are at the Tivoli Theater in Downers Grove. Saturday, May 18th at 10 a.m. Thomas Jefferson and I will walk onto the stage. We'll kibitz a little bit. You get to ask questions, too. If you like me on Facebook, I'm WGN King John. I really encourage you to just go see what 90 seconds of that looks like or so, and you'll get a sense of the intelligence and humor of this Jefferson. You know, Jefferson wrote, 20-some-odd thousand letters in his lifetime. I don't know that he memorized them. Our Jefferson pretty much did. And so when someone asks a question, you get Jefferson in his words as relevant to the question as can be. In historical issues, he's spot on. in interpretive issues, he does the best he can. For instance, what would he think of the current Congress or the current president or the current mayor of Chicago or throwing passengers off airplanes? He would tell you what he is Jefferson might have said about that. But it's fascinating either way. WGNradio.com/Jefferson is where you go to get tickets. We do a daily web poll question. We call it the News Click. We asked you yesterday, Illinois is the first Midwest state to raise the legal age to purchase tobacco to 21 now. And 25% of you said 21 isn't even old enough. 35% said that's about right. And 40% of you said it should stay at 18.
Actually, yesterday, John Henson and I were talking about that, and we agreed that both the age to buy alcohol and the age to buy tobacco products should be the same.
And should it be the same as the age to serve in the military? Because that's what happens at around 18. That's
yeah.
the logic for some
well,
people.
Well, then, yeah. Whether it's raised to 21 or stays at 18, they should all be the same age.
So we've become consistent with that finally here in Illinois, 21 and 21.
Right.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah.
But he was saying that it should stay at 18 and that the age to buy alcohol should be 18.
It's kind of weird because I guess what you're doing is you're saying we need you to be old enough to make a mature decision about your dangerous choice. As though if at 21 you decide to do something that will only be harmful in every conceivable way, well, then it's okay. You know, I mean, I don't exactly understand that. I guess fewer people will start smoking at 21 than will at 18, so that makes sense. But a lot of people, in fact, now that you mention it, does anybody start smoking at the age of 21? You're keeping them from buying cigarettes because you don't want them to smoke. Presumably, they're already smoking at the age of 21. If you're not smoking by 21, you see what I mean? So how is this really going to keep people from smoking? They're already addicted by the age of 21. They're already smokers by 21. If you say, okay, now at 21, you're old enough to make that decision, nobody at 22 decides to start smoking.
Yeah, it's kind of random. It's a random age.
There's got to be studies on that where they ask people who smoke when they started.
Let's just do this. 312-981-7200. 312-981-7200. Maybe you've quit. But just text to 312-981-7200 the age at which you started smoking. I don't care how much you smoked. Maybe you only smoked lightly for a few years. Maybe you are still a heavy smoker. Just text the age at which, because I'll bet we're not going to get many over the age of 21. And I'll bet we're going to get some 14s, right? 15s, something like that. I'd just be curious what we get. Do we have time to do this now, Ella, since I've yakked so much? It's 1:43. You're waiting now in your head, yes?
Yes.
Rick Kogan in today's Chicago Tribune, and a story headlined, it's the 20th anniversary of Columbine. A survivor of that school shooting is now a filmmaker, and you can see her We Are Columbine at the Music Box. Kogan began his story this way, and I read this sentence at the beginning of an interview earlier today to Laura Farber, the maker of the film. He wrote, "Talking heads, those familiar and often dreary elements of documentary films, have rarely been as powerfully honest and emotionally potent as they are in a spectacular new film that takes us all back to the bloody April 20th day in 1991 when 12 students and one teacher were slaughtered inside a Littleton, Colorado high school. That incident has been made into a documentary film that premieres tonight at 7 o'clock at the Music Box Theater here in Chicago. Just before the show, I talked to the film's maker, Laura Farber." You were in the school that day, right?
Yeah, I was. I was in the cafeteria.
What year in school were you then?
I was a freshman, a baby.
I wondered at times if there was a certain sense of ownership's not the right word, but was it more impactful to, say, seniors, do you think, than juniors, and juniors more than sophomores, and so on? Or did everybody at the school come away with the same sense and feeling?
I'm sure it was different for every class. You know, as a freshman, I just remember feeling, like not being able to comprehend what had just happened. So it was just a different perspective. And then, we were also the youngest, and then they're the longest.
I don't know where exactly to start, if we should walk through that day or if we should walk through the film process. You eventually left Colorado. You came to Chicago. You studied documentary filmmaking, and then you went back to Colorado to make the movie about Columbine.
Correct.
Yeah. What was that day like for you then? Do you mind walking us through what your experience was?
The day of the 20th, oddly enough, it's very similar to Amy's experience in the film. We were in the cafeteria eating lunch like a normal day. I knew I had a test later that day. I mean, I think we were there for maybe 10 minutes. And then a janitor came running down the cafeteria hallway and yelled, "Everyone get under the tables." And we got under the tables. I mean, not knowing, you know, you just sort of listen to authority, I guess, at that point. We just did it. I remember someone grabbing their nachos and bringing them under the table to eat. Couldn't tell you how long we were down there, and then all of a sudden, everyone just started running out the doors. I was probably the table closest to one of the exit doors to the school parking lot. Ran down the hill to a residential street and knocked on doors. There were about 20 of us just knocking on doors, trying to get in somewhere to get safe. And then finally, someone led us into their house, and we piled in there, turned on the news. And that's when we started hearing, you know, what I thought, you know, it was bombs, but gunshots. We stayed away from the window. We used his phone to call our parents.
So evidently the shooting had started, although you didn't hear it when you were in the cafeteria.
I don't remember, you know, I really don't remember hearing the sound of gunshots as I was running. Mm-hmm. It felt odd. It felt wrong. It felt like I was going to miss my math test. I mean, all of that was going through my head.
You graduate from high school eventually, and then you go back to make this film. Who did you select, and how did you select the people that you would profile?
Well, I knew I wanted to stick with the freshman class because that's what I knew, and that was my experience. And I, you know, I started with Amy, I guess, first because we stayed friends after graduation. And I kind of wanted to do a test interview just to see if, you know, if we could start talking about our experience, because I didn't realize we were together that day until I sat down and talked to her with the camera. And it all came back, and we just got to share that day together. From there, I think I went to Gus next. I mean, it was all organic, these four amazing people. And then also trying to articulate to the participants, you know, what my goal was and what I promised I wouldn't do. You know, I promised I wasn't going to name the shooters. I promised I wouldn't show any cafeteria footage from that day. You know, I was just going to say a lot of people weren't really interested in speaking with me also. You know, it's like we don't need to. We know what the other person is feeling, and we don't need to relive it. But yeah. I just felt like we never got to tell our story.
Is that why you made the movie then?
Yeah, it really is. I just, you know, I was determined to make this film about the collective experience of people who were there and not about the crime. And I wanted it to be solely about the kids that went through it and how we've been healing on our own, but also like how we came together to help each other, especially during those 3 years at the school. You know, and at the time I thought, well, maybe I could help future survivors of mass shootings, not knowing that we would have more.
When did you begin making the movie? When did you begin filming?
I started filming in 2012, actually, right before Sandy Hook.
And did you imagine it was going to be a process that would take this long?
No. I mean, I knew documentaries, you know, can take as long as they take. You know, you let the story unfold. I think that's one of the beauties of making documentaries is, you know, you have an idea, but sometimes that story can take you somewhere else. You know, a lot of it was also emotional to make the film. You know, it was very personal. So going through archive and stuff, I mean, that was pretty intense. So a lot of it was emotionally driven because of how long it took, but it was also, you know, financial. You know, it's not cheap to make a feature independent film.
Your four classmates agreed to talk to you. A lot of students didn't want to because they just didn't want to maybe relive, at least for a camera, this experience. But your colleagues that did agree would. Did you or had they already received some sort of counseling or therapy after the fact, or was this that?
They did. They received some. I know, you know, some more than others. But I do know that being back in the school was the first time for all of them.
So wait a minute, you took the camera and went back to the school with them during your school day or when the school was empty?
It was empty. We were allowed, so the school let us let me come in, which it was rare. I didn't think they were actually going to allow me to do that, but they did, I think because I was, you know, I was an alumni. You know, and I also thought that it was, you know, it was going to be different going back because I, you know, once we graduated, most of us left, and I guess what's the point of returning, especially to that space and to be back at ground zero of that day. It's one thing to share your story on camera, but then to do it where you were is pretty intense.
So is that what you did? Did you walk these students through where they were and had them retell their story?
Yep, in that moment. So we did a sit-down interview, retelling the story, and then walking through the school doing the same thing. Yeah, it's pretty emotionally draining.
Did you worry or have any sense that maybe this isn't a good idea, that this is...
No, I didn't. I thought it was, it may be beneficial, but I quickly realized that, you know, sometimes going back to the things that make you uncomfortable is another way to help you move forward.
Mm-hmm.
But they did it, and they did it with such courage.
Can you tell me one of the stories that they told that you captured in the film?
One of the biggest stories I think that I learned was from Amy, because we were together that day in the cafeteria when she was walking through the school. I took her, or she took us back to where her locker was during those 3 years, and then we started talking about, you know, that there were bombs in the school. I mean, we all knew that, but that there was actually one under our table, Amy and I's table in the cafeteria. I was not aware of that. So that was something that I learned in the moment on camera. And then, you know, you're finding that out. And as I'm like interviewing her, it was very emotional for me too. I mean, we had to take a break. So that was kind of hard. You know, you want to put your director hat on and stay professional, but yet it's so personal.
You talked to the principal of the school at the time, right?
Yes.
I was interested that he was willing to cooperate, too. I mean, maybe he appreciated the effort, but I could see him saying, it was difficult for me then, and I don't need to do that again now.
Frank DeAngelis, he was the rock, I guess, at the school, and he was the one that kept us together and kept us moving forward. And I didn't know, you know, it's one thing to talk to students that were there in freshmen at the time, but you don't think as a kid that these adults are also going through the same thing that we are. You know, they have their moments of terror and triggers, and they're healing as well. I just kept thinking, you know, I still called. I remember the first day of filming, I would call, you know, you say Mr. D, but, you know, he's like, call me Frank. You know, and then Kiki Leyva, I kept calling him Mr. Leyva, and he's like, could you please call me Kiki? So, like, you know, I'm still stuck in that, of a position of authority.
When he would come out of the principal's office for the first several weeks, he would burst into tears, or at least start to cry because of the emotional heft that he was carrying.
So Frank said that in the film, that it was hard for him to walk out of his office, you know, meaning it was hard for us too. And then Kiki clearly had his days in the, you know, some bad days in the classroom, but you're a teacher, you know, where do you go to take your time to, you know, to heal and cope with what's going on.
What was it like when you all went back to school? You then, after the scene was cleared, you all went to school elsewhere for a while. Eventually the school was repaired and you went back. What was it like when you went back to school? What was the contrast?
I think it was a mix of emotions. It was a little scary. I don't think for me personally, in the sense that this could happen again, but it was also with all of us being together was really helpful, at least for my healing. You know, whether we talked about it or not, at least we knew we were together. And everyone was super sensitive and compassionate. You know, like Zach says in the film, you actually ask how you're doing, how's your family doing? Not just, you know, hey, how are you?
Right. When you went back to school, either on that satellite campus or back to the Columbine itself, did academics or, I don't know, academic achievement, athletic achievement, did those things not seem as important then, or did the high school experience feel different then?
It felt different in that everyone was really nice, and we were all, I mean, we were just treating each other with respect and sensitive to one another. You know, not knowing what each person had been through, but it's just like, hey, if you were there, like, you know, I got you. And also, we were trying to live, you know, this idea of normal, you know, go back to being a high school kid as much as possible. You know, we still had desires of, you know, competing and representing your team and being part of a team. I mean, I think that was still there for a lot of us.
I asked you at the beginning of this conversation if the senior class felt it differently than the freshman class. Your class at least had to feel it longer than anybody else. You were walking those halls for 4 years, 3+ years after the fact. Nobody else would have been there and been through it as long as you in that way. I mean, to me, this must have been a more...
See, that's hard. I mean, you know, what I've learned is, you know, trying not to compare traumas also, you know, but I'm still curious. I can't imagine being a senior and going through that and then all of a sudden being away from everyone you know that's, you know, that was there that day. I mean, that's got to be tough to just get thrown into college with people that have no understanding of what you've been through and you're just supposed to figure it out. It's like being thrown at the deep end.
You don't dwell in the movie, right, on the violence per se?
Mm-mm.
I know you don't mention the name of the shooter.
Right. It's also, you know, images of violence, you know, in real time and replaying the same images over and over is painful. It is re-traumatizing. And sounds as well, I mean, those are painful to hear. They're triggers for someone that has experienced this trauma. They didn't want to do that.
Well, I think that's a sort of newfound wisdom. I know in the book Parkland, the author does not mention the name of the shooter, nor does he spend but a few pages describing in a sort of mechanical way the shooting at Parkland, and then he goes on to trace the lives of the students afterwards. And he's adamant
right.
that we should not either re-traumatize these people or glorify the act itself. And putting a name on it and describing it in some sort of gory detail does that. So there's no value in that. That's counterproductive, he says. I suppose you would agree.
100%. Absolutely. That was definitely a lesson learned. And I think, you know, we're getting better with that and not, you know, maybe not even focusing on just the headlines.
When people hear the word Columbine, do you share the fact that you were a Columbine at the time? Maybe you do a little bit now because of your work, but growing up since then and at that time, did you kind of not want to advertise that because of what would happen when people heard the word Columbine?
100%. 100%. Yeah, I definitely, you know, because I went away to school, so I was meeting people all the time. You know, where are you from? Even sometimes what high school did you go to? And I knew early on that as soon as I said Littleton, you know, they kind of look at you cross-eyed, like, how do I know that city? And sometimes I'd remind them, but I never said, oh, I was there. You know, I said, oh, yeah, it's where Columbine is. And then I'd leave it alone.
And your parents, mm-hmm. are they alive and well? And what do they make of what you went through at the time or your work on this film? I always have questions like that. So we'll pause it here. The interview that we were playing just before the news, I should have asked you to back it up about 10 seconds, Elif. Did you? Okay. So this is the final part of Rick Kogan's column in the Chicago Tribune today. That is, he talked to Lori Farber. She has this documentary film about Columbine. She was a student at Columbine. She then came to Chicago and studied documentary filmmaking at Columbia. She then, starting several years ago, was going back to Columbine, interviewing some of her old classmates, colleagues, the principal. She made this documentary film. She lives in Dallas now. It debuts tonight at the Music Box Theater here in Chicago, and I have not seen the movie. Kogan says it is spectacular, and it's something that unfortunately resonates still today. We were talking about the reaction that her parents had, and your parents, are they alive and well, and what do they make of what you went through at the time or your work on this film?
Yeah, no, they are alive and well. I think they were a little nervous that I'm putting myself out there to, you know, I was able to tell them the purpose of this film and what I was trying to do. And then, you know, once I actually completed the film, I think they definitely understood more how important it was to tell this story and why.
Mm-hmm.
I'm okay, I'm getting better, and I think this film helped me do that.
I wonder if they see the movie and they say, oh my God, Laura, I didn't know that, or why didn't you tell me that, or how are we just finding this out now? Were there revelations like that for your family?
Yeah, I think so, and I also think same for the participants in the film. I talked to a lot of parents, you know, at some of the screenings, and they learned a lot. Because we did, like I said, we just didn't talk. We didn't talk about it. It's not that my, you know, our parents didn't ask. They asked all the time.
Mm-hmm.
But it's, you know, you say I'm fine,
uh-huh.
or you brush it off, or, you know, it's just something that you keep to yourself. And I know, you know, in high school kids tend not to share much anyway, but this was something, and I'm sure it was hard for them as well to, you know, just not knowing and then wondering, you know, is Laura okay? If I tell them I'm okay, I guess, what, you know, where do you go from there?
You know, that's it, Laura. I mean, I had adolescence at that time, and you must appreciate the fact that when you ask a teenager how you're doing, they'll say fine, even though they're mad at their boyfriend, or they're worried about this test, or they're just, you know, their hormones are there, and they don't want to talk. But when a kid goes through
right.
what you all went through, and they say that, how does a parent, what do they do with that? Maybe you're not fine. I'll bet you're not fine. So now what do I do? And if I pester you about it, maybe I make it worse. It's this awful circle, you know?
Yeah, it is, and it's tough. I just know that, I mean, I would never say stop asking, as annoying as it might be for the teenager, just knowing that you're, you know, that you're there and you're supportive
mm-hmm.
goes a long way. You know, they might not tell you, but if you just ask and make sure, and I know, I think all of our parents tried to push some counseling on us because it was available, but if you're not ready, you're not going to go. You know, or you can go, but it's not going to have an impact like it might when you're ready to actually talk to somebody. You know, and that didn't happen until later on in life, you know, for a lot of us as adults. And we were finally ready to say, hey, I can't live like this anymore. And I need to do something about it, talk to someone, get some, you know, some therapy. And there's all kinds of therapy, all, you know, EMDR and tapping. I mean, there's all different stuff.
I wonder if anybody's done a survey of what happens to students who collectively suffer something like that, and then what is their rate of substance abuse or alcoholism or other destructive behaviors because they can't cope. You know, your class, your school would be an interesting case study in that.
Yeah, well, I think a lot of us, you know, did abuse substances of all kinds. You know, and sometimes that can be a phase, and sometimes that can take you down a rabbit hole that's not pretty. If you don't take care of yourself, I think that's number one. You know, you got to be selfish there.
Yeah. Do you have a message then, finally, to leave our listeners with? I mean, so based on this film, based on what you reveal or discover, what should we know? Is there a prescription or a bottom line here?
I mean, I just, you know, I think we're getting it now, but, you know, healing just, it's not one size fits all. You know, stop judging yourself, and you can be selfish. And then more importantly, I think what hit home for me through making this film was that, you know, we did the best we could. And I think if we could just remind ourselves I'm doing the best I can every day, then that's, I mean, that's a great way to cope.
And maybe acknowledge that it will be an everyday. This has become your life, and maybe you'll never get to put it on a shelf and say, okay, fixed that. That this is just going to form you, and it's going to be how you're going to live, and you'll live a happy and productive life, but that will always be part of your experience.
Yeah, part of it and not defining it.
I just finished a book called Spearhead about a tank gunner in World War II who, at the age of 88, goes back to the scene of the battle and is still, you know, processing what happened in his wartime combat. And some of the things that you are talking about sound very much like things a World War II veteran is to this day having to process. Had a great life, but... And did not define him, but
right.
was also something that, you know, was part of his maybe day-to-day experience. And I suppose there's some similarities there, huh?
Totally.
Yeah.
Totally. I think any trauma, right?
Yeah.
There's all kinds of trauma. And that was the other thing, was I really wanted to reach trauma survivors of all kinds. I think this film might be able to help people.
That's a good aim, isn't it? And that's Laura Farber. She is the filmmaker who, she's not in town then. Well, yeah, no, she is in town for that. Is she, do you know Laura or Elif going to be at the screening then tonight at the Music Box Theater at 7 o'clock? Music Box Theater at 7 o'clock. I don't know if you can still get tickets to that. You might check that out. It sounds powerful. You can tell I didn't see the movie. Rick Kogan did at the Chicago Tribune and just could not say enough good things about this emotionally potent film, as he describes it, in the Tribune today. It's 2:14. Yesterday at WGN Radio, you all, I was gone. I was actually doing the morning show for Steve Cochran. We're talking about the law in Illinois that says you got to be 21 to buy tobacco now. I asked you at what age you first started smoking, because what's the point of saying you got to wait till 21 when people have already made the decision to start smoking? And you texted in, started smoking at 18, got loaded at a college party, 15, 13, 14. John, I started at 45 while golfing with a lot of friends. John, I stupidly started at 24. Unhappy emoticon. Lots of unhappy emoticons and emojis here. 16. John, I started at 12, was a regular smoker by 15. Started smoking at 22 after a relation imploded. Started smoking at 14, quit 39. Smoked from 15 to 30, quit when my first child was born. At 18 when I started, John, was in the Army. John, I started at 16, then quit at 24. Then started again at 34. One of you said, well, so I was just looking at the ages. 15, 14, 22, 14, 14, 16, 13, 12, 16. That's about what I thought. Have you been to Navy Pier lately? I talked about this the other day, that last summer I rode my bike down to Navy Pier. I don't live that far away. And then from there got off the bike and did a walking tour of Navy Pier. And I came away enthused. I don't know what your image is of Navy Pier. Maybe it is, it's great. Maybe it is that, yeah, I've been there, done that, and it's fine for the tourists, but it's not my thing. And I'm telling you, you should reconsider that. Marilyn Kelly Gardner is here, the president and CEO of Navy Pier. Welcome to the studio. How are you?
I'm doing well. Thank you, John.
Sitting next to you, by the way, is one of those new businesses there, or business that is new to Navy Pier by a couple of years, Stephanie Hart, who's the owner of Brown Sugar Bakery, one of the stores on the Pier. Nice to meet you. How are you?
I'm awesome. Thank you.
Yeah, I don't know what you do there, but it already sounds good. What is the Brown Sugar Bakery?
I am a Southern dessert bakery. I bake all that stuff that has all the good stuff of your childhood memories.
So what do people, what's the specialty of the house?
Caramel cake.
Really?
Yes.
It's
caramel.
Phenomenal.
Is it?
It's number one.
That's what people come for. You know, I was talking to a guy who ran a bakery on the South Side, and caramel cake was a big thing. Is that a Southern dish? Is that?
It is definitely. Definitely Southern.
Yeah.
It is. But Chicago, for some reason, really embraces it. I think that particular migration by way of Mississippi to Chicago really makes it a real big cake here.
Huh. Talk about here, Navy Pier. Do you agree with my assessment that maybe people don't know Navy Pier now?
That has been our impression. And we are so grateful that Chicagoans are rediscovering or discovering the new Navy Pier, just like you, John.
Do you call it that, the new Navy Pier?
Yes, we do.
As of when?
We started our reconstruction in 2014 and have transformed the public spaces on the pier with much more to come, I might add. But it is now truly a showcase for what's best in Chicago. And the spaces, as you discovered or rediscovered, are much more open, bold, and contemporary. And we showcase now experiences that can only be found in Chicago, like Brown Sugar Bakery. So it's really a much more authentic experience when one visits Navy Pier, and we're hopeful that all of Chicago, like you, comes back and discovers that it's not their parents' Navy Pier, it's not the Navy Pier they grew up on.
Yeah. We're sitting in the 18th floor of a building at 303 East Wacker, which overlooks the river, the lake, and Navy Pier. There are not many people that have a better daily view of Navy Pier than I do. The Ferris wheel is quite a signature for it, isn't it?
It certainly is. It's quickly become an iconic fixture on our lakefront. This centennial wheel was opened in 2016 to celebrate the pier's centennial as we have begun taking the pier into its second century. So it's really become iconic and certainly a treasure on the lakefront.
Is it the most visited tourist attraction in Illinois or Chicago?
So it's the most visited attraction in the state. We draw 9 million guests on an annual basis.
Really?
Yes. And a little over 5 million of those guests actually come from Illinois.
Yeah.
So it's more of a local destination.
And so what do you do when you go to Navy Pier?
Oh,
how do you do? How does somebody do it? Do they come and eat? Do they spend the day? Do they come and shop and then go back? I mean, what's the way to do Navy Pier?
The average guest is at the pier for 4 to 6 hours. I mean, there's so much to do and experience. Aside from the fabulous dining and the wonderful treats that Stephanie serves up, the boat tours, dining cruises, the IMAX theater is at Navy Pier. We host 250 free programs on an annual basis. So not only are we showcasing local businesses at the pier, but we're also a platform for the hundreds of emerging and established cultural and arts organizations throughout the city.
Would you agree with me that a way to do it would be to pick something you're going to do when you get there, right? I mean, you could mosey up and down, as I did one day last summer, but having done that, my recommendation would be plan on doing the Sea Dog, or what's the tall ship, the Windy?
The Windy.
The Chicago Windy. It looks like a ship Christopher Columbus came over on, right?
It's a four-masted schooner.
It really is, and then people get on it, and then you go sailing out onto the lake.
And actually, you get to help raise the sails.
I could not believe it. Yeah, I was like, holy cow, I guess it's safe. These people are just out there sailing. It's spectacular. It looks like fun. It looks very authentic. You know?
And there really aren't any better views of the city than from out on the water.
So that's my idea. So I would take time to, like, say, okay, we're going to eat at one of the restaurants and have a meal. You know, take an hour and a half or whatever that would be. Or we're going to do a boat tour. And then on either side of that, you know, budget another hour to go get some treats, or to just leisurely walk up and down, or maybe do the Ferris wheel ride. You know what I mean? Make a half a day or a day of it that way.
Right, and I think you'd find there's so much more than you imagined at the pier.
Well, so how many boat attractions are there? That was the other thing that kind of surprised me. I'm familiar with the Sea Dog and the water taxis and, you know, the architecture boat tours, but what all is floating out there?
Well, and don't forget, too, Chicago Children's Museum and Chicago Shakespeare Theater are also at the pier.
Well, that would be one of the, yeah, go see a play, get there half a day early, spend it that way.
Absolutely, and then take the water taxi to the museum campus, for instance.
I have done that
before.
Or
along the river.
I don't know how you, this is another, you should do Chicago this way. Go to one of the location or the other, but we started several years ago. We went to Navy Pier, got on the water taxi, then took it over to the museum campus, right? We went over to, I think, the Shedd Aquarium.
Yes.
They had jazz out there that night. They do jazz on the lawn, and you can sit there, sip a beer, look back from either side back into the city, which is just like, how better could you do Chicago than that?
Right. It's phenomenal. And all summer long, we have wonderful programs on Monday evenings. There are movies in the park. I mean, it's just a wonderful experience and a unique location.
You do fireworks still?
Of course we do fireworks.
Twice a week in the summer, right?
Every Wednesday and Saturday, all summer long.
Wednesday and Saturday. So when does that start?
Memorial Day weekend. So the Aon Summer Fireworks kick off Memorial Day weekend and run straight through Labor Day weekend twice weekly.
So is there a restaurant row or food court? Or are you all scattered all around? What's the food scene like?
The food scene is so exciting. I'm so glad to represent Chicago with some of the best of Chicago. There's city chicken, and we have a big bowl, and we're getting a gelato. We have a great tiny tavern. I call door number 5, which is right by Shakespeare Theater, the cake and cocktail corridor.
Why is that?
Because you can have a piece of cake and then have a cocktail, too. How much fun is that?
Is that, yes. Are you over by Navy,
yes,
or by Shakespeare?
I'm right by Shakespeare Theater. So that's a lot of fun for me, too, because we get to collaborate a lot. So I love it. I love the row, and I love the fact that restaurants go all the way down.
So let's see. Is it Ditka's or Harry Carey's? One of them is there?
Harry Carey's is at Navy Pier.
Yeah.
Yes.
So if I wanted to eat a whole meal, I mean, the restaurants, sit-down restaurants would include that, right?
Yes. Harry Carey's, Riva, Giordano's, Bubba Gump's, Margaritaville. But, Harry Carey's is really a Chicago treasure and, an iconic location, and
is Brown
Sports Museum as well.
Yeah, I noticed that. Is Brown Sugar Bakery a sit-down place then, or do you get
no,
and go?
This is a get and go. But what's really also very cool about the new Navy Pier is there's all this public seating, so you can just kind of sit down. There is seating right around.
I noticed that too, and I've got to stop saying I noticed that too. But you know I'm an advocate, and one of my complaints about Michigan Avenue, the Gold Coast, just a lot of the public space in the city, is that there isn't enough places. Where are park benches along Michigan Avenue, or in some of the courtyards by the Equitable Building? You just don't see that much of that. And I'm sure there's a reason for it, but whatever that is, as a consequence, you don't get a chance to sit there and have your piece of cake or your hot dog or your soda or your coffee, whatever. Navy Pier, I think, understands that. I noticed that there were plenty of places to do just what you described.
And there's all kinds of park areas to kind of sit around. My daughter is 26. Her friends were just into Chicago. And one was from Korea and one was from Germany. And she took them there. And their visit was totally different than mine. They found all these great places to do what they love to do, which is take all these selfies. And it looked like they had been all over Chicago. They were outside. They were inside. They were on boats. They were in restaurants. And it was all at Navy Pier.
Hmm. What's the best picture, would you say, of this city? Would it be to go on the north side of the pier, looking back into the beach and up the skyline? But then you miss the loop. You miss maybe where Sears Tower is. So I don't know. How would I do that?
Well, one of my favorite, I'll call it newer views of the city, comes from the city stage at Polk Brothers Park. So there are now two, there's a performance lawn and a city stage. The performance lawn utilizes the lake stage that uses the pier and the lakefront as its backdrop. But then on the flip side, we have the city stage where there are graduated steps and a lawn that utilize the skyline as a backdrop.
Mm-hmm.
So just spectacular views that have been there for hundreds of years, but were never truly celebrated, which we've done now. Or right down at the far east end of the pier, or from atop the Centennial Wheel, you look back and see the entire city.
Are those on the north side of the pier?
I would stick to the south side.
South side. And yes. Is that at the base? Is that right towards the beginning of the Navy Pier?
No, all the way down
the
east end.
Yeah,
way down at the end.
Huh. One last question about that. Parking, how do people do that?
Parking there, we have about 1,600 parking spots right on the pier, and we also have designated drop-off and pick-up areas for Uber and Lyft, since so many people are turning to rideshare.
Yeah, or riding their bikes.
And public transportation. We have about 200 buses, CTA buses, that stop at the front of the pier during the peak season and the summer.
When I was there, there was some activity going on the lawn in front of the pier. I'm trying to remember what that was. They have a fountain the kids can run through.
Spectacular fountain. But then you probably saw some of the unique programming that's hosted on the Polk Brothers Performance Lawn.
Yeah, and that's that area that we're describing, the
yes,
Polk Brothers
correct.
Performance Lawn, right at the beginning when you just walk over there. One last thing for Stephanie. So, caramel cake. What else am I going to get?
Banana pudding, sweet potato pie, all kinds of different cupcake flavors, and cheesecake. We make really good cheesecake.
Hmm. All with this southern Chicago flair?
Absolutely. My cheesecake has a butter cookie crust, which is so Chicago, because, you know, Chicago's famous for that, you know, school butter cookie, and that's what we use for our crust.
Cupcakes, gourmet cupcakes are all the rage these days.
Yeah, these are gourmet with a southern flavor. I'm not really trying to make cupcakes that, you know, you didn't have as a child. So we're going to do all those great flavors from your childhood with a twist. I turn ideas from my childhood, like I have a rainbow sherbet cupcake, which tastes just like rainbow sherbet.
Wow.
I have dreamsicle, and we do lemon cream cheese and things that remind me of my childhood, pineapple coconut, and things like that.
Wow.
So I don't know if that's gourmet. We make a taffy apple cheesecake. How Chicago is that, right? Everyone loves the taffy apple in Chicago, and then to add it to cheesecake with a butter cookie crust.
Yeah. I was just gawking at your Instagram profile, Stephanie.
So my producer's been gawking at your Instagram profile. Is it very visually satisfying?
There's a video of someone glazing the caramel cake, and it just keeps going and going and going, and the layers just keep being added on. And in the caption, after I couldn't stop watching, I read the caption, and it said, "I bet you can't tear your eyes away."
And that was true, too, right?
Accurate.
Yeah, yeah. Okay. No admission charge to get on. Just head on over at your convenience, right?
Absolutely. Come all summer long. There's always something new happening.
Marilyn Gardner is the president and CEO of Navy Pier, and Stephanie Hart is the owner of the now going to be even more successful Brown Sugar Bakery. You may recognize that from the West Side and the South Side, too. Has it always got the same name wherever you are?
Brown Sugar Bakery,
Sugar Bakery, also at Navy Pier. Ladies, congrats, and thanks for coming in.
Thank you so much.
And let's get more warm weather and more people at the state's number one attraction. 9 million people visited there last year, 4 million of which were from Illinois. Did I get that number right?
5.4 million.
5.4 from the state.
Correct.
So obviously a big tourist attraction too then.
Absolutely.
Well, more power to us. Thank you, Steve Bertrand, and thank you too to Marilyn Kelly Gardner, the president and CEO of Navy Pier, and Stephanie Hart, whose business is Brown Sugar Bakery on the West Side, South Side, 70-something, 100 South, 79th. And then at Navy Pier. You may have noticed that Stephanie Hart had a really wonderful voice. It was kind of low, and I was going to comment on that during the conversation, but she mentioned to us off the air that her daughter is with the Lyric Opera for the first year now and is booked through the year 2020. She is a great opera singer that the city has produced. So good voices run in families, and evidently good food does too. The Brown Sugar Bakery, one of the stores at the new Navy Pier. Thanks, Marilyn Gardner, for coming in too.
And I just sent you the video of the cake being glazed on your on your Instagram page.
Oh, good. I'm WGN King John on Instagram, on Facebook, and Twitter. So check out the
Brown Sugar Bakery USA Instagram.
And it's of a cake being glazed? Is that
with caramel.
Yeah.
And now that you and I have both been introduced at the same time by that other place.
Yeah, right. What was the name of that?
Angelica's.
Angelica's Bakery, which is, I don't think that's in the city per se, is it?
No.
It's south suburbs. It was Flossmore, maybe? No,
yes.
Was it Flossmore?
It was around there, yeah.
Yeah. Is everybody amazed at the kind of sentences that are being proposed for Lori Loughlin and Felicity Huffman? Holy cow. They want them to go to jail for life. Solitary confinement, hard labor.
Well, I don't know if you're up to speed, but Lori Loughlin was charged with another crime today.
Well, that's the money laundering, right?
Right.
So how
but
does
not
that
Huffman.
Say it again. Yeah, not Huffman. And so that, right, because in fact, we threw up the news clip when we first heard about Felicity Huffman's charge and that she pled guilty to in the possible sentencing. And they were saying 4 to 10 months in jail. 4 to 10 months in jail. Can you imagine? So you have three options. That's too high. That's about right. Or that's too low for Felicity Huffman. Then they do the Lori Loughlin thing, and they say, what are they suggesting for her because of the money laundering and the deceitfulness that she's being accused of? How long could she go to jail, Steve? Do you have the?
Well, I mean, you know, they have the maximums and they have the guidance, but these aren't repeat offenders. So I don't know. I mean, from what I was hearing this morning, they didn't think that Felicity Huffman would do jail time.
Oh, no kidding.
Right.
I was reading 4 to 10 months.
Well, I mean, I think that's the federal, that's the guidance that it could be.
Do you think she should go to jail? I mean, like, at the end of the day, maybe Lachlan, you know, laundered money to hide the ridiculous amount of money that she...
Well, you know, it all depends on how offended you are, because people would may ask the same question of Jussie Smollett,
yeah.
Right?
Well, let's not complicate things with the Smollett thing.
Okay.
But, I mean, this is gross behavior, and it's a crime available only to the rich.
That reminds me of the Smollett case in many ways. Oh, I'm sorry, I did it again.
Steve?
I think you can get blood out of that turnip in other ways, right? Let's take a lot of cash and help do some good for people.
Right, scholarships for like, right. So for each of them, if they have a child who got into a school they would not otherwise have, what would 4 years of tuition be there? Just drop that on some kid somewhere.
She should be forced to create a Felicity Huffman scholarship, a sustainable scholarship at a school her kids couldn't get into.
Except I wouldn't call it that.
It'd be more painful.
Well, I would not want to be the recipient of this year's Felicity Huffman Scholarship.
Well,
given each
right.
year to a kid who otherwise wouldn't get into a school, but because this one lady cheated, we're going to let you in for free. I don't want that scholarship. Actually, I think did you see the story on the CBS on Sunday? I guess NYU's med school is tuition free now. Their endowment is such, the philanthropy has been such that the students that are there don't have to pay tuition. It was something we talk about a lot on this show, student debt, and that the kids that graduate from the school will have, say, $200,000 in debt. Granted, they're going to be doctors, but think about that, $200,000 in debt. And you don't get rich right away, and you won't get rich anytime soon if you are carrying interest on $200,000 in debt. And they said, forget about that. Here's what the problem is. The prospect of $200,000 in debt, or the cost of med school, keeps students who would be able to be good doctors from ever going. So it sort of discriminates against the poor, the inner city kids, the rural kids who just don't have much financial backing. They're not even going to try. And they might be very smart. They might have had great bedside manners, but they'll never become doctors. So what do? You get kids from my neighborhood, and you get kids that go to New Trier, and you get kids that go to the good schools in Champaign. But you don't get a broad... We're leaving a lot of talent on the table because of the cost of getting into those schools. So they had this scene where the president of the university said... They had like this assembly. It was the White Coat Assembly where the med students, I guess, they've been inducted into the school and now they're going to go to school. And they're getting their white coats to learn to be doctors. And their parents are in the upper reaches of the balcony and the students are in this auditorium on the floor. And then he comes out and says, I just want you to know the following. Everyone here, tuition is free. And there's a beat. And then the place goes bananas. But, I mean, they literally were like, you said what? Excuse me? You're happier, in a way, for the parents than you are the students, because either the parents are going to pick up part of that note, or they have a better sense of the burden that will represent to their children. And it was a bitter pill maybe they were all going to swallow, but they were going to swallow it. And they said, but you still have to pay for your room and board. So what's that? Yeah, that's $15,000 or $20,000. I don't know what it costs these days for room and board, but the $200,000 they just dropped on those kids. Isn't that amazing? So I'm wondering what you think the appropriate punishment is or penalty for Felicity Huffman and Lori Lachlan. I just don't see what harm they've done to society, right? Like, at the end of the day, I think people should be locked up who, if they got out, will beat you up or will run up and steal your money or will sell drugs to your kids, right? And these people did things that were wrong, but I'm not interested in as a taxpayer in paying for their room and board at a minimum security prison. I'll bet you're not either. The idea that they would have to go to jail, I think, is kind of ludicrous. I have no sympathy for these ladies. I don't see the point in punishing them any further than they've already been punished. And, like Steve said, let's just take some blood out of that turnip. Pick a number And let's get Smollett size money. Let's get $127,000 from each of them. Times two. That'll teach them. They've got it. 312-981-7200. I'm interested in your reaction. Please, 312-981-7200. 217 says, guys, even Martha Stewart went to prison. Martha went to jail for the same reason a lot of people go to jail. Martha did not go to jail for what she did. She went to jail for lying about what she did. I don't know that these people necessarily did that. Lori's plea deal is 2 years. It's all over the internet, John. Thank you. 2 years? So Lachlan's plea is she's going to go to jail for 2 years? Hey, John, 708, maybe Kim Fox can get their charges dropped. It's 243-312-981-7200. Call or text WGNradio.com. This is John Williams. I don't have the White Sox score. White Sox are on the radio side. We're here on the stream. Thank you for finding us here. If you want to listen to White Sox baseball, go there. If you don't, stay here. Remember, we're always on the stream. So if you're listening to the radio side and you go, shoot, they're going to do a sporting event and I don't want to hear the sporting event, go to WGNradio.com and we'll continue our normal programming there. It's a luxury afforded to you that we didn't used to have and one that some of us aren't crazy about. Once upon a time, if you had a day game, you would say, so long. Here's Cubs baseball. Here's Northwestern football. Here come the White Sox. And then you'd be off. And it was really a beautiful thing because you still got paid. The only challenge was that if your show was preempted, this is total inside baseball now, if your show was preempted, you had to be on standby in case it got rained out. Or the roof collapsed in Minnesota. They'd say, hey, the roof collapsed, or it's raining. They're bringing the tarp back out, so we'll send it back to our stations, and then you'd be the guy. So you could kind of relax, but you had to be ready to chit-chat. Those rain delay conversations were the weirdest things, because you'd say, okay, I'm on. What am I going to do? And they say, well, talk for about 12 minutes. They think they'll be back at 2:30, and you go, okay, 12 minutes. What's a 12-minute conversation? Should we get somebody and interview them? Should I just start talking? Because then they'd say, they're 12 minutes, they go, yeah, it's still raining, keep going. You're not a playlist. You say, okay, I just wrapped up that thing, so now I'm going to give you a few more minutes. The big gamble was you'd say, hey, my show goes till 3. It's 2 o'clock, and they're playing. I'm going to go home early. This happened to me more than once. I'd get on the Eisenhower, and I'd continue to listen. This is when the Cubs were on the station. And then Pat Hughes would say, you know, Ronnie, those clouds are starting to come over. And I go, oh, crap. And then one day I'm driving, I'm at the Oak Park exit. And Pat says, yep, so here comes the tarp. My blinker goes on, take the first exit. Now I'm racing back eastbound on the Eisenhower because they'll do a little chit-chat, play a couple commercials, but they're going to go back to the local station. It's my shift. So now I'm heading back into town. And Pat Hughes says, you know, actually, it looks like we're going to keep it right here. I'd take the next exit, turn around. So I was just kind of going back and forth on the Eisenhower for a while. Back to the Lachlan and Huffman stories. So what's the deal, Producer Elif, that they're cutting now?
Well, because Lori Loughlin and her husband didn't enter a plea deal, the prosecutors are saying that they could face a minimum of 4 years and 9 months and up to 5 years and 11 months for money laundering. And then it says just for the bribes, they could face 2 years minimum.
Yeah, but I thought, did they reach a plea agreement or not?
No.
They did not.
They didn't. It says they didn't enter a plea deal. No. Unlike Felicity Huffman.
Who did.
Yeah.
Actress CNN says, actress Lori, I say Lachlan. Do you say Loughlin?
I think it's Loughlin because it's G-H.
Yeah.
And yeah, I just got confirmation.
From
Anna DeFontes.
Who is our...
My mother-in-law follows her very closely because she had two shows on the Hallmark Channel.
Ah!
Misses her tremendously.
My wife is a big fan of that channel. So it's Loughlin, G-H?
Loughlin is the way I've always heard it.
Yeah. Well, then from now on. Actress Lori Loughlin and 15 other wealthy parents, CNN says, now face an additional charge of money laundering as part of the growing college admissions scandal. The parents who were charged last month with conspiracy to commit fraud were charged today, Tuesday, in a superseding indictment with conspiring to launder bribes and other payments through a charity run by Rick Singer, the mastermind of the scam, as well as by transferring money into the United States to promote the fraud. Laughlin and her husband, fashion designer, let's go to Anna DeBlantis for the correct pronunciation.
Massimo Giannulli.
Massimo Giannulli.
Giannulli. He has a range of clothes. I mean, many people will know him from Target because he's got a line there that's very popular.
Which one is that? Do you recall?
Massimo.
Massimo. Target has great clothes.
I know.
I didn't know that was him.
That is him.
Wow.
Yeah. Seriously.
You know.
Heidi Stevens, right after Felicity Huffman and Lori Loughlin were indicted, posted a picture of the two of them. And they have a similar appearance. They, you know, they have long faces. They're attractive Hollywood stars. And they both have that same sort of hair. It's kind of an auburn brown with streaks.
Lots of highlights.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And Lord, they're rocking it, right?
Mm-hmm.
And Heidi Stevens said, you know, I don't know if I'm ever going to go to jail, but if I do, I want this look.
I want to look just like that. I mean, it's got to be impacting him, although they didn't look like it as they were showing up in court. They were smiling and signing autographs.
Lori. Yeah, I know. Don't do that. I don't know how you're supposed to behave when you're on your way to jail or when you're trying to avoid jail. But I would not go to Springfield and go to a club the way... thank you for this. John, lots of community service or pay for education of a few students. I think that would be a good idea. Well, Lori was on the Hallmark Channel all the time. Can't wait for the movie to come out. And maybe they'll borrow her real-life story for a...
Gee. I mean, a very charmed life, for sure. It's it does seem as if she may actually see prison time.
I just think that's stunning. Laughlin and her husband, Massimo Giannulli, are accused of paying $500,000 to the fake charity to get their kids into the University of Southern California. The couple appeared last week in federal court in Boston. They have not publicly indicated how they plan to plea. In addition, there's a whole bunch of other names here. We're also charged in superseding indictments. 33 wealthy parents are among the 50 people arrested last month in a sprawling investigation dubbed. I didn't know what this investigation was called. You know how they always give it a fancy, clever name?
Right. What
so
is this one?
What would be a good name for this?
Ooh,
Operation
Elite School. That's not good enough. Sorry.
Varsity Blues.
Mm.
Wasn't there a movie called Varsity Blues?
Yeah, Rob Lowe was in it. It was rowing. It was about rowing teams.
Operation Varsity Blues. Prosecutors said the parents used their wealth to cheat on standardized tests for their children and bribe college administrators and coaches who had say over who is admitted. The added charges come just a day after 13 parents, including actress Felicity Huffman, and one coach agreed to plead guilty. Huffman, the former star of Desperate Housewives, pleaded guilty to paying $15,000. I don't know how she gets her kid in for $15,000, and the Laughlins have to pay $500,000. Does that say something? Maybe I don't know if those are bragging rights, but you go, well, we only have to pay $15,000. It costs you $500,000 to get your knuckleheads in that school.
I don't. It seems very
that's
random.
That's not fair, is what that is.
Well, a lot of it. This story is not fair. It seems that the feds are really trying to pressure the families that have not admitted guilt to say, "Look, it gets worse for you, not better," by throwing these new fines on them, attaching new longer prison sentences to those particular charges. It's getting ugly.
I just see society, I see jails as being used as a way to make society better. That is either you as a menace to society are no longer on the street, you can't beat anybody up anymore, or by sending you to jail we'll keep other people from doing it. I don't know that either of those are necessary in this case. I don't think they're going to be repeat offenders. They're not going to harm you or me in any way. I think this is surely sent a signal that this is going to be tolerated. The consequences will be grave. I would definitely kick their kids out of school because they're there under false pretenses. I would fine them. I mean, really, at the end of the day, this is maybe these people don't want to go to jail either, but it's about money. So let's go ahead and take a lot of their money. Let's not take 15,000. Let's not take 500,000. I mean, find some measurement, find some math, apply it, and say it's going to cost you X number of dollars.
I like that.
What's the point of putting him in jail? Laughlin's daughters were recruited to USC as coxswains. You may now go look up coxswain.
That's the usually the smaller person who sits at the front of the boat and yells out the orders for the rowers.
Yeah. So not only were they not even rowers.
they were just boat sitters.
You don't even have to be. It's like we're going to fake everything anyway, but they didn't even then give them an oar. They just threw them on the front of the boat and said, stroke, stroke. I mean, they probably could do that. All right, more about that still to come. Rokan just strolled into the studio. Anna DeVlantis is here prepping her show, but I'm not letting her get any work done, Ro, because I'm asking her how to pronounce things and stuff like that.
The story is pretty stunning, though. And you know what I'd love to see, too, is and maybe it's already happening, but all of the universities and colleges just doing a top-to-bottom review about admissions at this moment in time. Because you wonder if this is the tip of the iceberg or if this is really an exception.
I think it's time to have a blue ribbon panel. You know what they always say they do that whenever there's trouble? Well, we're going to put together a blue ribbon panel.
That you'll never hear from again.
Yes.
But they're going to study the crap out of this thing.
Right. Well, I don't...
I'll bet this happens a lot.
Oh.
I do, too.
It's been going... I always bring this up, and I'm not trying to be political when I say this, but, you know, one of the more famous cases that, you know, we can all point to was when Fred Trump built a building to get his kid out of Fordham to go to Penn. Right? I mean, that's not...
I didn't know he was a transfer student.
Yes. He didn't start at Penn. He started at Fordham. And so this is not a... I mean, this has been going on forever.
Is it like Jared Kushner in your mind then, too?
Kushner
donated a building too, didn't he?
Yeah, was it Yale, I think,
mm-hmm.
for him? Yeah, I mean, Yale, well, there are a lot of people who've gotten into Yale. If you watch the Bush series, it's really interesting because they talk a little bit about that, the Yale legacy. And once you're a legacy, once you're a family member, it's a lot easier. You get preference for that. So it's about getting, starting a whole tradition. I never fully understood. I know USC is one of the best schools in the country, but I never fully understood, what the dynamic was there. To really work. I mean, they spent a lot of money.
$500,000.
Yeah, to get their kid into USC. If I were them, I'd go. If I'm going to go spend $500,000, I'm going straight to Harvard. I'm not going to screw around with this. There's got to be a crew team at Harvard.
Well, but it maybe it's a reach for her.